Hi, this is Fraser. I just wanted to step in before I run the show for tonight just to say that we had a technical problem recording this week, our first in 115 episodes, so that's not bad going. But what happened was that my Mac locked up solid during the recording, and we normally, using the magic of podcasting, I can figure out how to work that away, but the fact that just where it was that happened this week, we couldn't really fix it. So I have corrected it with an amusing sound effect, which you will notice, no doubt, as you go through the show. So the other issue that happened was that because of that, I had some file system corruption, and as a result, I've had to complete the rest of the show using Bradley's Skype recording of my voice. So as a result, the sound quality is not everything we would hope it would be, and I apologize for that, and we'll get back on track next week. Enjoy the show. This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears, and I'm joined again for this new year by Bradley Chambers. Tonight we have three sponsors for the show. The first being Jam Software, makers of enterprise tools that power widespread use of Apple technology such as Macs, iPads, iPhone, and Apple TV in education. More about them at jamsoftware.com. By Shobi, an app for paperless classrooms. Shobi makes it easy to assign, review, and collect student work, and to provide rich feedback with annotations, voice notes, and more. And finally, this episode is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, and online store. For a free trial and 10% off, visit squarespace.com/outofschool and enter the code PUPIL at checkout. A better web starts with your website. Bradley, 2015, eh?
Happy New Year.
And to you. How's it been?
Well, the New Year's Eve, you know, it's funny. There's a lot of pressure with that holiday because you feel like you've just got to have this exciting night. But it's actually the worst holiday around. I mean, it's the worst holiday of the year because all you really want to do is go to bed. So, you know, here in America, your options are to, especially if you have kids, is to hire a costly babysitter, go to a party that you're committing yourself to for at least 5 hours, assuming you leave right when the ball drops. So you can then watch Ryan Seacrest for 5 hours.
That sounds like a recipe for torture. Is the CIA using that one now?
Yeah, it's the worst holiday. And I kind of gave up on the fact that, you know, we have small children. And in a few years, we'll be able to go to parties where the kids can come with us too and can hang out and stay up that late. But we're just not at that place in our lives just yet. Nope. So we just did nothing. We got to go from Olive Garden about 5:30 using a gift card we'd been given for Christmas. We ate that, put the kids to bed, normal time. I think we may have watched a movie. I think we watched some football. I guess Americanized football. My wife went to bed about 11. That's true. My wife went to bed at about 11. And I told her, I said, I'm staying up. I'm going to do it. Because last year, I went to bed at 9:30 because we were transitioning my youngest son into his crib from his like little sleep sack thing. So that was I was getting rid of sleeping in shifts. And so I said, I'm staying up till midnight this year. And I fell asleep at 11:45 watching Seinfeld on my phone.
So, yeah. On your phone.
That's yeah. The way the world is now. Yeah, I was watching off Plex. So, yeah, it's the worst. It's the worst holiday.
Yeah, it's also the one you're wasted after all the other holidays. You know, you've had Christmas, you've had Thanksgiving as well, and then New Year just comes along and takes the last bit of energy you've got.
Yes. So, did the Spears family have a wonderful Christmas?
We did. Yeah, it was mostly Lego based, and some of that involved Lego friends, so haters can hate. But the girls are really into Lego this year, so. Even Georgia got the little baby Lego, which is, I don't know if they sell that in America. It's called Duplo.
Yes.
Sort of chunky baby Lego. She got some of that. And then April got Lego creator stuff and Beth got Lego friends. And it was Lego wall to wall. So I've just been snapping together Lego since December the 25th. And I really haven't stopped yet. I'm certainly not finished. There's some very large kits were handed out this year.
Well, that's a great point because I posed that question to a friend of mine the other day. I don't understand the point of Legos if the parents put them together. I mean, do you play with Legos once they're put together?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know Beth. Beth is 7, and she definitely looks at them more as toys that you have to assemble first, whereas April looks at them more, and April's 10, so she looks at them more as a kit of things I can do the sort of doctrinaire construction with, but then I can also do other things with it afterwards. But Beth is very much invested. And I think with the Lego Friends range in particular, she's very invested in the kind of storylines that come along with that kit because it's got more personable characters in it, female characters and so on, that she finds that she wants to kind of invest in the story that comes along with that particular kit rather than looking at it as something that she'll build from in the future.
Before we move on to our first few topics of the night with Thinker, first sponsor, this episode is brought to you by the fine folks at Squarespace. It's the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, and online store. For a free trial and 10% off, visit squarespace.com/out of school and enter the offer code PUPIL, P-U-P-I-L, at checkout. A better web starts with your website. Now, you guys have heard about Squarespace on a million other podcasts, but they keep having new people sign up from podcasts, so they keep sponsoring podcasts, which is a great thing. But if you're tired of dealing with websites, you know, not working right, getting hacked, updating plugins, Squarespace is where you want to go. It's hardware and software all in one place. You don't have to rent a server. You don't have to install software. You just sign up. You're good to go. If you pay for it by the year, you get a free domain name. Otherwise, it starts at just $8 a month. All plans include e-commerce. It hooks into Stripe, so it's incredibly easy. You have a great blogging app from iOS. They have 24/7 email and chat support. It's incredible. It's people that actually know what they're doing. They're not just reading a manual. They actually understand how to use Squarespace. And they've got a great version 7 that just came out. That's an entirely new backend that really takes what they launched in version 6 and tightened it up and made it even better. So if you have a website you want to start this year for a project, or if you want to sell something, you have a new app, Squarespace is where you want to go. Again, go to squarespace.com/out of school and use the offer code PUPIL when you check out, and you'll get 10% off. So, you know, one of the things we were going to do this week, as you know, it's really what you do in the technology world, you kind of look back at the year. And you know, over at the Sweet Setup, I posted an article about, you know, tech resolutions for 2015, but there's a lot of things in 2014 that happened that we can kind of think back and sit on and can give us an idea of where we're going in 2015 and kind of what are the clues in our industry. Like what's the heartbeat of our industry right now? Because to me, it feels a lot different at this point today than it did last year.
I completely agree with you. And I think also one of my kind of overarching themes for 2014 is that it was a year where the other shoe is yet to drop in a lot of things that happened. The biggest and most obvious one with that is Apple Watch, which was announced but not shipped yet. But I think there's plenty of other things that you can say that is an interesting trend, and we'll see what happens with that in 2015, 2016, and beyond. So there's definitely more to talk about from 2014 than just what happened in that calendar year. But I think a lot of new and interesting trends started this year that are not complete yet.
So let's start out with let's look at Apple. You know, we got the new iOS deployment methods, I guess, in the spring with the managed distribution and device enrollment program. And that was huge stuff mm-hmm. when that was released, because that was really kind of out of nowhere. That was in the spring. And then we got WWDC. We got iOS 8, and there was a lot of excitement about that. You know, you and I, if people go back and listen to the show, we were very, very excited about some of the new features, the extensions, to a lesser extent, keyboard support. And so, you know, where are we with that?
Now, those were things that we had been asking for a couple of years, I think, Bradley, certainly since iOS 7, if not actually 6 as well. Things like extensions, easier sharing, you know, easier moving of documents between different silos. And I think, you know, we're sitting here 2.5-3 months on from iOS 8 shipping, and I think the overarching feeling I have right now with iOS 8 is a bit of disappointment. You know, yes, the features are there. Yes, some of them, in particular, the idea of extensions, I think, has definitely changed some of the ways I work with iOS. The integration between, say, 1Password and Safari is now something much almost identical to what you've had on the Mac for years, whereas other things, I think, haven't quite lived up to the promise. And, of course, the big one that was controversial towards the end of the year has been iCloud Drive. And I think, if you remember, I was pretty skeptical about iCloud Drive to start with. Mainly I was concerned that Apple was introducing the same kind of complexity, file system complexity on iOS as existed on the Mac. It confuses a lot of new and even intermediate users. And I think with a lot of the App Store rejections that have happened around about functionality relating to iCloud Drive, it seems to me that there's a bit of nervousness within Apple that may actually be true for most people as well, because a lot of the more advanced things that some apps are doing with iCloud Drive have been restricted, or, you know, Apple have gone back and forth with them in app review as to whether or not they should be allowed to do things like create folders inside iCloud Drive, things like that. So iCloud Drive, I think, has still to settle down in a large way. Some extensions are pretty good. The keyboard stuff seems pretty rough at the moment. But I think the broader story, I don't know how you feel about this, Bradley, but I certainly feel that the broader story about iOS 8 is that it's a second strikeout on quality. iOS 7 was not great in terms of its quality in its first releases, and iOS 8 has been the same. And I think once is an anomaly, twice starts to feel a little bit more like a trend, and something I've certainly ended the year being very concerned about is Apple's software quality as a whole. And I don't think I'm alone in that.
Well, I've got two things there. If we are to use these tools in our workplaces and organizations and build workflows around them, we cannot be building workflows around apps that are then asked to remove features. I mean, imagine if you had built something around Transmit and its use of iCloud Drive in your workplace, and then they just took it away. And to me, the tale of the tape is that, like, it's, let's say I have, here's a good example. Like, if I buy something, you know, my phone that it's for work, what I will do is I will get that email. I'll send it back to PDF, convertpdf.me. Is that the website?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We'll take an email and we'll turn it back to use a PDF. That's a fantastic feature. So it's convertpdf.me. And if that's not it, I'll put it in the show notes. I'm kind of having a brain lapse there. And then I will do open in, and I will open it into Google Drive. And I've got a folder that I will put it in called to process. And then on my Mac, there is an alias to that folder on the desktop. And so when I get to my Mac and I need to print out some stuff or need to process it, that's where I'll do it, because I have to log it into our ancient PO system that they have an iPad app, but it's basically looks like a remote desktop into a Windows app. Not kidding. And so the fact that I'm still not using iCloud Drive for that, I think, is the tale of the tape. That it's just become another product. It's nothing. If it wasn't built in, would you install it? No, you wouldn't.
No. Yeah, you're exactly right. And would you, if it was a paid service by itself, would you pay for it?
No.
Certainly not.
I mean, no. I don't even trust it. I literally, the only thing I have stored in there at the moment are some Pages documents and some Keynote documents. Now, and I know that iCloud Photos is in beta, but beta is a different term in 2014 than it was in 1999. And I don't know if you know, if you read the article this morning, that the iCloud Photos had disappeared from iCloud.com.
I did not know that.
No announcement, just it's not there. If you had the URL hard-coded, doesn't load. Now, I'm sure they're probably like prepping for the Mac app release and things like that, but that kind of stuff today is just really not acceptable. You can't just, I mean, imagine when Gmail was in beta, if Google just took it offline for a day. It's in beta. We're going to take it off. No, it doesn't work that way. If you're going to let us use it, it has to stay up and work. And I think you're right that this is strike two. And I always wondered, like, you know, the thing that got to Microsoft in its heyday in terms of quality was its inability to fix its virus problem with XP. I mean, that was when you really started seeing problems. And even after they fixed it, it didn't matter. The damage was still done.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, is this like, you know, Microsoft couldn't get away from their legacy stuff, so that their code base was, you know, so bloated and they just impossible to keep track of. It's almost like Apple's fault is they're moving so fast, they never have a chance to fix what they already have broken.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think that you're right to put your finger on reputation damage as probably being the biggest problem here. But I don't see any one particular bug as being as catastrophic as security failures in Windows XP, although the big issue around iOS 8.1 and iCloud Drive and the big slowdowns that it was causing with inside apps was a huge one, and that certainly took long enough to get fixed. But I feel like now a lot of people are looking at these products thinking, man, these are really expensive and they don't often work very well, so I'm going to maybe hold off a little bit longer. And I know I'm certainly looking at the Apple Watch that way now. If you'd asked me, you know, after the watch announcement, I said, yeah, I'm definitely getting one of those. Maybe I'll get the cheap one, but I'm still going to get it. Today, I'm thinking, well, maybe I'll just hang on a little bit and see if it actually turns out to be as good as people expect it is. And I think more and more now, you know, every time Apple gets up on stage and talks about some new service, a lot of folk are looking a wee bit askance at it, you know. And I think that is the thing. When Microsoft talked about security, everybody was sort of laughing up their sleeve at Microsoft. And when Apple talks services, I kind of feel like people are a wee bit the same today. So, yeah, the damage to the reputation, I think, is the most painful part. And I feel it in particular. I don't know if you feel this way too, Bradley, that when people ask you for a recommendation for something to buy or something to adopt, I feel nervous today, you know, talking to them about Apple products, because I don't feel that I can stand behind that recommendation in the same way that I used to either.
No, that's exactly it, because my boss was like asking about buying an iPad for his mother, and he was like, you know, what does she need? iPad, you know, iPad Mini, iPad Air, iPad Air 2. And I was just said, what does she do? And everything she was going to do, she could do on a Chromebook. And in fact, very easily. And I pitched it to him. So why don't you just get her Chromebook? It'll be cheaper, you know, even in the iPad Mini. And he said, well, he said, I probably would agree with you, except she lives an hour away, and I'm going to be the one having to do remote tech support. So at least I know how to use an iPad. Yeah. Yeah. And so, the, you know, Apple's got that going for them. But, you know, a year ago, I would have said, no, get her an iPad. It just, that's mm-hmm. what I would have said. And I don't even, I can't even put my finger on exactly what the issue is, but like keyboards are a big mess. Like I actually uninstalled every third-party keyboard app I have. Not that the keyboards were bad, but like something when they're loaded just makes like, you accidentally hit the button and it gets really slow and it disappears all of a sudden. You have to reboot the app. Mm. I just, whatever. Like the only one I was using was underscore David Smith's emoji keyboard, which is fantastic, and it's not his fault. And I paid for it, you know, gladly. But I went back to the regular emoji keyboard because it doesn't have that slowdown. But I feel like that's an iOS thing because it happens with all the keyboard apps.
Yeah, I feel like it's, like you say, Bradley, it's just a sense of a general kind of malaise about the whole thing. That it's not really any one major bug. It's just all kinds of little things just don't work correctly the way you expect them to. I mean, the iPhone 6 Plus, which I think has been one of the more interesting things that came out of Apple this year, I still find issues with it where it's just things like, you know, sometimes you'll turn it on, you'll press the home button and the screen doesn't turn on, then you've got to press it again. Or you've got to try two or three times to get the control center to come up from the bottom of the screen. Or, you know, it's just stuff like that. A rotation just doesn't quite work. Sometimes you've got to shake the phone one way to put it back the other way. And it's just all these small little things. None of them showstoppers, and all of them with quite obvious workarounds, but you just feel like, you know, I just dropped £750 in this thing. I don't really feel like it should have that level of high-frequency workaround involved in it, and that's the disappointing factor in the whole thing for me.
Well, that was what we always pitched the Mac to people. It's like, yeah, it's more expensive, but it's a lot more reliable.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess it is. I mean, it depends on what you're doing. I don't know.
Well, I don't know. I mean, we just had a hard lockup of my recording Mac here while we were doing the start of the show. So it's not, to me, it's more expensive and it's nicer, but it's not, it doesn't feel to me more reliable anymore.
And my year and a half old $1,700 MacBook Air tells me to service the battery, so I'll be replacing the battery probably next week. So there's that. But, you know, I guess, you know, looking ahead, you know, we got to fix things like that, and we've got to get, you know, in the education sector, we've got to get AirPlay fixed. And that's just the showstopper. I mean, that's because things like that, yeah, they're peripherals, but that's a key feature of iPad in schools.
And I think that's something that was pushed so hard as a component of an iOS deployment was the use of Apple TV. And I think even if you go to schools that don't really know very much about iOS at all, the one thing they know is Apple TV means wireless presentation. And if that doesn't work, and it doesn't work, that's a huge problem, and it's an embarrassment every time it goes wrong as well. So this is something I've got in our notes for what happened this year at Cedars, is that one of the things for next year is the possibility of us actually just taking out our Apple TVs and going back to VGA, unless something happens pretty soon, because it is just not good enough.
Well, and you wonder, this coming this spring, will we get enhancements to the deployment model? And I don't even know what we need at this point. It really is, you know, it works. It seems like it works fairly well. I haven't heard about, you know, any major show-stopping bugs, but you wonder, will we see something this spring?
Yeah, no, I think device enrollment, I haven't used device enrollment myself, but I certainly think managed distribution has worked very well and has solved a lot of the kind of problems that, and it has been very reliable. To be fair, that is one product that came out of Apple this year that has worked as advertised from the first day, is for us at least, is managed distribution. I think one of the things, I was talking to a friend earlier today about this, he goes and works in a lot of different schools as well, and one thing that always turns out a red flag for us is when people think they've just figured out a way to deal with Apple IDs that is, you know, just gets around this or gets around that. And I think the trick with a lot of those programs is to do it the way that Apple says to do it, and then it does tend to work reasonably well. Not always, of course, but if you think you've found a way to beat the system, you probably haven't, and that's something to be aware of.
Before we move on, let's thank our second sponsor of the night, the fine folks at Shobi. Now, Shobi is an iPad app for paperless classrooms. With Shobi, teachers can quickly and easily assign, collect, and review student work on their iPads, and then provide rich feedback to students by adding annotations, text notes, and voice notes directly onto documents. Students can show their learning creatively by submitting to Shobi from thousands of compatible iPad apps or by completing assignments with Shobi's built-in tools. Shobi keeps everyone organized with individual student assignment folders, email, and push notifications. Now, the cool thing is, Shobi is completely free. They have a basic version that teachers can try out with their students and be up and going in just a few minutes. You can go get it in the App Store, or you can click on our website and go to the show notes for this week. This is episode 115, and we'll have a link to the free version. And if you want to look at the paid version, they have a special deal for listeners of our show. If you buy five teachers, they will give you an additional five teachers for free. So that's buy five Shobi Pro and get an additional five for free for all their students for a year. So learn more about that at shobi.com/out of school. That's shobi.com/out of school.
Okay, so I think that one of the big themes for us in the podcast this year, Bradley, particularly in the second half of the year, was increasing interest in Google alongside our interest in Apple. Now, we've been long-time Google Apps schools. You know, we've been on there since 2006, and I think you've been on since about 2008. So it's certainly, we've got plenty of mileage on the tires of using Google Apps as institutions, but I think more and more interest, particularly for me, and I think also for you, towards things like Chromebook as well. We've been tracking it for a while, but I think this year, and particularly the second half of the year, was when our interest really ramped up in a big way.
Yeah, I mean, they've starting to get more powerful, but their prices have stayed fairly steady. And I think that's the important thing.
And that's something that I was definitely skeptical about. You can go back to previous episodes of the podcast and hear me say, I am concerned that Chromebooks, in order to get faster and more powerful, will have to also get more expensive. And it really does appear that that has not happened. I bought a Chromebook just a couple of months ago for the same price as I paid for a Chromebook 7 or 8 months ago, and it's 3 or 4 times faster. I think perhaps not trying to be a tablet has helped them keep that price down. They're kind of reaping the dividends of all that development around about desktop computers and the form factors, and people know how to build a laptop pretty well. That's kind of a finely honed art now, and Chromebooks are really getting the dividend of that. So it's been an interesting time to be a sort of outside observer of Google and to see things like Android 5.0 come along in material design. And I think I was in the shopping mall recently and looking at in a mobile phone shop. And one of the things I noticed, because it was something I was interested in looking at, was that almost all the Android phones that were on sale that day were still running Android 4.something, 4.2, 4.4, and none of them had Android 5.0 on them at all. And it seems to me one of the interesting features of this is that material design is probably most widely available right now on iOS, because most of the Google apps in iOS have adopted that design style at the moment. So that's kind of where I've been experiencing that new development from Google, is on the Google apps I use in iOS. Things like the Google Search app, I'll be using Google Inbox as well, which I really like. And obviously Google Maps got material design as well. It's not perfect, and there's certainly a bunch of inconsistencies about it, but it's certainly a lot less unpleasant than previous versions of Android, certainly to my eyes.
Well, and Google Apps is really as influential as ever in our school. You kind of look back to, you know, Google's strategy when they were really pushing this back in 2009, 2010, on schools moving to Google. They're giving us Postini for free, really doing everything they could to get us over. You know, in hindsight, that was a genius move, because they got us locked in and using that platform that's very difficult to leave. I mean, it would take a lot for us to leave Google Email, because rarely any downtime, seems to just work, and it's free. I mean, you know, it works.
How do you beat that?
Right. Yeah. I mean, maybe move to something else that's free. But again, you don't have the Google Drive. You don't have Google Docs. You don't have Google Spreadsheets. I mean, our entire budgets on our church and our school are both done on Google Spreadsheet. Like the you know, not uploaded after the fact. I'm talking, it is planned and done. These are complex spreadsheets done completely in Google Spreadsheets. Yep. And so why would we leave that? And, you know, on the flip side, that makes us more wanting to look at things like a Chromebook, because if you're a 365 school or you're using a Mac OS X server, you're not going to probably care about Chromebooks.
Mm-hmm. No, it's very much the kind of Trojan horse that in behind which other things are coming, and primarily Chromebook, I think. And we certainly had that experience as well over the past really 2 years, that obviously Gmail has been the cornerstone of school communication for many years now. And then later on, kind of post the iPad deployment, Drive came along as the next thing. And then from Google Drive came Google Docs. And then, like you, Bradley, we've moved a lot of our processes into shared Google Docs. And on the back of that comes Chromebook. And the challenge for an Apple deployment is that Chromebook is the kind of logical consequence of all of those things that have gone before. Whereas iPad has its own strengths and interests, certainly, but it is definitely not as well aligned with that larger platform that the school is built on. So a lot of people think of Cedars as an Apple school, but at another level, you can read it and you can say, well, actually, Cedars is a Google school who happened to use iPad at the moment. And it just depends at what level you're looking at the school as an organization, whether or not you would call it a Google school or an Apple school. And I think that's where Apple's lack of investment in the kind of back-end structure leaves it open to risk, because Google has invested heavily in that back-end, possibly to the detriment of leading on the front-end with Chromebook, but they've certainly built the back-end so it's robust and reliable and easy to manage. And they're doing exactly the Microsoft strategy, which is take care of the sysadmins and the rest will follow. And Microsoft worked that strategy to a T for years, where they knew who their customers were. And their customers are not the consumers. The customers for Microsoft were the sysadmins and the IT directors and so on. And the decisions that those people made, if their life was made easy and straightforward, then that would be the decision that would lead to deployment of those technologies for the users. And Google are playing that playbook to perfection. In fact, they're almost playing it better than Microsoft played it. Apple are simply not playing that playbook at all, except in certain circumstances. But even things like device enrollment and managed distribution, there's still a gigantic missing chunk, which is the kind of Google Apps dashboard for Apple IDs. And I think that's something, that's an area of real risk for Apple, is not taking care of that back end at an institutional level, which is where I kind of feel that their solution is weak compared to the others right now.
You know, one of the things that's, you know, kind of got me thinking through, you know, what like 30 to 40,000 unit deployments would be, is can someone come along that it's like the Dell and be a system builder that you could go to and say, look, we want these specs, that we want 13 inches, we want 4 gigs of RAM, we want 32 gigs of storage cache, and we want this processor. We want 40,000 of them. Can you build it? With Dell, you can largely do that. I mean, you can basically build a, you know, build a computer. That's what that's why they, you know, became so popular. And with Chromebooks now, I don't feel like you can do that just yet.
No, you've kind of got your pick of specific models, plus or minus a few different things like RAM and storage a little bit. And what's starting to happen now is different choice of screen resolution is starting to come in as a thing. Some Chromebooks now coming full 1080 panel, some coming with less than that. But yeah, you're right. It's not clear to me exactly how many parameters you may or may not want to tweak with a Chromebook. I mean, it seems like RAM matters a little bit, but it's not clear that the 2 gig RAM Chromebooks aren't necessarily performing substantially worse than the 4 gig ones. And the amount of onboard storage is largely a function of how much stuff you want to be able to download locally and keep around before you upload it to some other service. So it'll be interesting to see how much more variation comes along with Chromebooks in the next year. And I think one of the big ones that is coming down the pipe is 15-inch Chromebooks. There's already a couple of rumors and mentions that Acer, for example, are going to do a 15.6-inch Chromebook by March of 2015. So that's a trend that I'm going to be tracking quite closely over the next year, is bigger Chromebooks. Because as much as I'm really impressed with this Dell 11, I would like a bigger screen, particularly when you allow room for the browser Chrome that you have all the time. I know you can space it out and hide it, but it's still a factor in your use of the device. So it would be interesting to see, you know, how would that feel on a bigger screen, as well as a faster computer, which we've already got. But how would it feel on a bigger screen as well? And I think 15-inch Chromebooks is going to be, and more variation in Chromebooks as well, is going to be an interesting trend for 2015.
Before we finish up, let's thank our last sponsor of the night, the fine folks at Jamp Software. They've been with us for, gosh, I guess over a year now. Jamf Software provides IT staff with enterprise tools that power widespread use of Apple technologies such as Macs, iPads, iPhones, and Apple TVs in education organizations. Now, again, they've been with us for, gosh, well over a year. Been a great partner of ours. So if you're looking for a way to really take control of your Apple deployment, go to outofschool.net, and they've got a special URL that you can use to let them know that you heard about them from our show. Now, if you're doing this in a school, they've got a great app for teachers called Casper Focus that allows you to really learn, you know, take control of the in-classroom experience. Teachers can initiate AirPlay. They can select a specific Apple TV. They can choose and distribute iBooks, and they can do a whole lot more. So again, go to outofschool.net. This is show 115, and use that special URL and learn more about the Casper suite from the fine folks at Jamf Software.
Yes, indeed. So, Bradley, how was 2014 at your school?
It was, I guess, not exciting because we did nothing, I guess, new at this point. Our Wi-Fi is nearing the end of its life. When I say end of its life, it's not that it's old, but our lease will be up soon. Mm-hmm. So we're looking ahead to 802.11ac. I'm going to be doing a site survey, you know, and actually probably in the next 2 weeks to see, you know, what kind of changes do we need to make. You know, actively looking at, you know, at what point do I just cut off 2.4 gigahertz, except in maybe the more heavily, I guess, dense areas like the auditoriums and things like that. But, you know, in the classroom, mm-hmm. do we even need 2.4 gigahertz anymore? You know, just thinking through things like that and kind of, you know, really doing more thinking and pondering and research than anything, you know, looking at our next deployment, that it's really this time next year we'll be, you know, probably signing the papers on some sort of deployment. And so is that an Apple deployment? Is that a Chromebook deployment? Is that a Surface deployment? You know, we legitimately don't know. And the thing that, you know, we always said when we went to Apple back in 2009 is that we're not doing this to be cool. You know, we're not an Apple school because that's the cool thing. Like, we felt like that was the best decision at the time. And we felt that way, you know, since then. But you have to, as you look at spending a lot of money, you have to think through that and think like, okay, what do we do? And how do we do that? And there are other alternatives that are cheaper that provide the same level of reliability. Because PCs were always cheaper, but they got to be less reliable. And so, you know, is, you know, an iPad deployment only more stable? Is a Chromebook deployment more stable? Do we keep mixing in laptops as well? Just things we think through. And we have to do it under the, you know, under the motivation of what's best for our school. You know, not what looks best on the website, not what looks best to prospective parents. What, you know, is it cool that we say, hey, we have iPads in the classroom or we have Macs in the classroom? Like, that doesn't matter, you know, if that's not what the best tool is. We've got to find the best tool because you have to look at these things not as brands but as tools. And I'm all about reliability. You know, one of the things you tweeted a few weeks ago was that, you know, things happen in the classroom that require the IT got to come in and people see kind of the inner workings of how that things works. Like, we failed. Like, that it should be so seamless that it should be effortless. Just as like turning on the lights is a great modern of technology, but no one thinks about it. Like, just flip the lights on. Mm-hmm. Our technology in the classroom should be that way.
Yeah. I think, I don't know about you, Bradley, but I think in the past 5 years for me, if I look at, excuse me, what I used to have to do at school versus what I have to do now, I'm in a different stage of my career, I suppose, as well, that 5 years ago, all I was doing was teaching class and keeping the computers running. But now I'm also doing data protection work for the whole school. I'm doing timetabling. There's curriculum development work. There's all kinds of higher level things that I'm now dealing with, as well as all that previous stuff. So I'm even less tolerant now than I ever was before of unreliable hardware and software. And I think you've got to look at it from one point of view as a total cost of ownership proposition. And that was always the big argument that we used for being an Apple school in the first place, was that, yes, the computers themselves cost more money, but I spent a whole lot less of my very, very, very expensive time relative to any computer hardware. Time is much more expensive dealing with that stuff. And what I find now is that that equation, that calculation is open to reinterpretation now because the value of my time has gone up again just because of the other demands on it. And I feel that the computers have to get more reliable again. And that's a key question overall. So I think, like you, Bradley, my year at Cedars was quite quiet. The biggest problem we had this year was we had an absolute nightmare second half of the year with our internet connection at school. And what happened basically was that we were using a 50 megabit connection from Virgin Media, which is one of the cable modem companies in the UK. And around about October, just as we came back from the October holidays, they pushed firmware to our cable modem, as they can do. And they've been doing this for years, I presume, because it's never been a problem before. But they basically pushed bad firmware, which caused the problem of the internet basically stopping working every so often. And it's been described to me various ways, but basically what I think happens is that the cable modem continues to operate correctly, but it stops talking to all of its Ethernet ports on the internal side of the bridge. So it looks to the company as if the cable modem is up and running, but in fact no traffic gets through and it's sort of dead on the other side. So it looks to them when they probe it, it seems like it's working fine, but on our side it's not working. And this has just been going on for months and months and months now. And it's now at the point where they're emailing customers and offering to upgrade them to a different connection for free to take us up to 150 megs with new, because that uses new equipment. And that's how problematic this seems to have been, is that they can't actually seem to fix this problem at all. So the situation we were at the end of the year was that I had basically installed a wall timer, a socket timer, to turn off the internet every period break during the school day, so that if on the hour, just about every hour, the internet would drop for 1 minute and come back on again, and that was enough to reset the connection and keep it going for the next hour, which has been pretty disastrous last quarter of the year. But I'm thinking I might take them up on their offer of an upgrade to new equipment in the new year and see if that fixes the problem.
Well, it'd be one thing if you're having to reboot it every night, but every hour is pretty terrible.
And sometimes it's been every 20 minutes. I've been through that as well. So,
yeah, we, I mean,
fortunately, it's not a long walk to the it's not a long walk to the cabinet from my classroom. But if it had been, that would have been very annoying.
That world is just foreign to me. I mean, we've literally, I had an outage maybe a month ago that was about a minute, and by the time I got them on the phone, it was back up. Our phones and our internet dropped, and that's the first outage that was like not weather related I've had, and I guess ever that I remember. And that's really, you know, and that goes back into our question of like cloud services and your reliance on those. And you can't, it's not practical to live in a world that you just have, you know, a local email server, because that, things like that, there's so much that does on, you use that with external people that's not just in your building. So saying we're going to have a local email server because our internet keeps going down. Well, that's great if all your email is only internal, but you know, your internet being flaky is as bad as a flaky switch.
Yeah, and what I've realized over this period is that the change to Chromebook, should it happen, wouldn't be any more problematic, because what I know is that when the internet goes down, even when we're using iPads, which ostensibly can run offline quite competently, all work essentially stops, because so much of what we do is dependent in some way on an internet connection. Even if we are working on, I don't know, let's say we're making a keynote presentation, that's fine, but I want to look at the internet at the same time or whatever. Or my Chromecast gets unhappy when it can't reach the internet, even though I'm streaming something, I'm mirroring something from a Chromebook locally. So I feel like the internet just, whether or not you're based on a cloud model or whether you're based on a local software with sync model, you're still completely dependent on your internet connection for really getting your work done. Even if technically, yes, the software can operate without an internet connection, doesn't mean you can actually achieve your tasks without it. So that's why it's been such a problem for us over this past couple of months.
So we're, you know, this year will be, you know, 2015 is going to be a year of serious examination and probably a lot of serious discussion, meeting with our board and thinking about, you know, looking at financials, because, you know, let's say we don't have the money to sign another $100,000 lease with Apple. Chromebooks are a nice option if we can't afford it. I mean, I would like to at least be able to have the option, but I think Apple is no longer in a situation with the iPad where it's, and especially the Mac, where it's like, it's your only option. Like, and 2 years ago, I wouldn't have said that, but now it's like, if, you know, we all were snarky 2 years ago when someone said, hey, we're doing a Nexus deployment. Well, I'll do a Chromebook deployment. But like, somebody does that now, it's like, okay, you can make that work. Like, you have a plan. If you follow our deployment plan and just, you know, replace equipment where we talk about it with your, you know, what you're doing, the same principles still apply with vision, leadership, planning, deployment day, all that still applies. Just the pieces will be different. And that's a problem for Apple when they can't seem to have reliable software and there are legitimate alternatives, then in a lot of situations are not only half the cost, but if you're comparing a Chromebook to a laptop, could be 20 or, you know, 70% cheaper. I mean, literally 70% cheaper. And that was the discussion that I've been having with folks here when they talk about Chromebooks. Like, oh, it can't do this, it can't do that. Okay, there are things it can't do, but it's also 70% cheaper. Is what you're doing, yep, is it worth the extra cost? I could give you literally three Chromebooks for the price I spend on your one Mac.
Yeah, I mean, it's the difference between having a trolley full of Mac laptops and having a one-to-one Chromebook program. If you want to go for the laptop form factor, I mean, I would argue that for most schools, the Mac is already not an option just purely from a cost point of view, except in the most wealthy private schools that I know of in the world, really, who can actually realistically ask parents to provide that kind of funding over a 3-4 year period for a Mac laptop. And I know there are some schools who do that, but most schools are realistically looking at a choice between an iPad, some other kind of tablet, or a Chromebook. Well, and they're playing in that sub £500 range.
And if you're at the school that, you know, and I'm sure we have listeners that are at one-to-one Mac schools, like talk to other schools, like the financial situation you're in is just so drastically different than they're in, you know, like, and we're in a really good spot as well, but there's so many schools that, like, if I could go to gigabit internet and probably not break the budget. A lot of schools, like, couldn't even afford another $50 a month on the internet bill. Like, their budget is that tight where they cannot, you know, add anything on. They can't even afford to add Amazon Prime. They don't have the budget for it.
Yeah.
And that's where, when you have things that are drastically cheaper, like, you have to look at it, because the way I look at it is the less money we, like, if I can get a Chromebook deployment for $30,000-$40,000 versus a $100,000 deployment with Apple, that's money that could go towards financial aid.
Mm-hmm.
We could get kids in here that couldn't afford it otherwise, and that's a great thing. I mean, that's kind of like always my mindset is, like, any dollar I save, that's another dollar that could potentially in the future go towards financial aid.
Yeah, most definitely. I did a little bit of financial modeling around about this recently, and I don't want to share the exact numbers yet, but one of the models that I put together, the model we have at the moment is everybody gets a 32 gig full size iPad. And that's just a sort of flat rule across the whole school. Should we switch to Chromebook for, say, the upper 30% of the school, the upper third? What does that enable us then to do with the other two-thirds of the school? And previously, one of the reasons why we did a full-size iPad for everybody was because it was easier to handle one device, and the older, physically bigger kids needed the bigger device to type on and so on. But if I take those kids out of the equation and give them all a Chromebook, what does that mean for the remaining kids? Can I then give them, say, an iPad mini instead of a full-size iPad and save money on that, the part that remains an iPad deployment, as well as saving money on the part that changes to being a Chromebook deployment? And that's an interesting possibility as well. If you split off your high school pupils from the rest of your school, what does that enable you to change for the existing kids who remain as part of an iPad deployment? Do they have to have the same kinds of iPad? Can you maybe go back to 16 gigs for them? Or do you go to 32 gig but an iPad mini? Or do you keep doing the same thing? And there's more to play with there, but you can actually possibly realize more savings than just the difference between iPad versus Chromebook for the section of the school that may change to a new platform.
Yeah, I mean, because if you're making the change, you might as well look at all of it.
Most definitely.
Just don't use the first-gen iPad mini, please.
Oh, well, I'm certainly hoping by the time we come to sign anything, then that will be gone. Certainly hope that will be true.
So what else does 2015 hold? We mentioned having a serious conversation about Chromebooks, and you mentioned removing Apple TVs from your classrooms. I really think that we are less willing to accept bugs this year. I think that you've hit the nail on the head. We've had 2 years. You know, we're tired of the fall rollouts where there are just these major show-stopping bugs, and I think people are just not, you know, the glamour has worn off, and we're not going to put up with it anymore.
Yeah, I completely agree with you on that. I think it's one of these things that I was having a conversation recently where we were talking about, I was comparing and contrasting Apple and Google for somebody who works in education, and the thing I was describing to them about Apple was that as we've gone to this kind of world where you've got the same kinds of things on the phone, the tablet, and the Mac, then say like iWork, for example, the unification of iWork that happened this year, that introduced a kind of coupling across the entire platform that is quite difficult to manage now, because what it means is that when everything moves forward, everything has to move forward at the same time. If you think about Like, your phone has to be upgraded, your iPad has to be upgraded, your Mac has to be upgraded to the latest versions of the operating system so that you can then upgrade to the latest versions of the Office suite so that you can then interchange files with students. Because we had a number of situations over the past couple of cycles of this where the students would update their devices quite quickly, or I would update them quite quickly for them, and the teachers wouldn't update so quickly or perhaps couldn't update because they had maybe an older iPad. And then you get in the situation where the kids have created iWork 2.0 documents, they're sending them to the teachers, and the teachers can't open them because they don't have the latest version and can't get the latest version of iWork. So things like coupling iWork to the latest version of the operating system just increases the tightness of the coupling across the entire Apple platform in a way that isn't true of what you might have thought of as the more monolithic approach, which is the Google approach. If you look at the new Google Sheets, for example, our older files still live as the old version of Google Sheets, and they open in the old version, and the newly created files open in the new version, and the two are running in parallel in a way that you can't run two versions of the Apple stuff in parallel, certainly not on iOS, and with some difficulty, and quite a lot of confusion, I might add, on the Mac as well. And it's fascinating for me to look at that and say, well, historically, one of the reasons for having local storage and local installed code and locally executed code was that you could control which versions you ran when and where. And that control seems to have sort of been taken away from you a little bit with the tight coupling between these programs and the operating system, such that if you want the latest versions of the apps, you've got to get the latest version of the operating system. Whereas on the web, where we sort of think of that as being the monolithic thing, where there is like the one Google Docs, the one Google Drive, the one Gmail. In fact, multiple versions are running in parallel in a much more convenient way than the experience that we're having on iOS. And that's an interesting challenge as time goes on. How tightly coupled are all these things going to get? And what does that mean when some parts of your system can't move forward in the same way that other parts can? So like people, teachers who maybe invested a lot of money 4 or 5 years ago in equipment, or even just people, never mind teachers, they have Macs that are moving forward into the Yosemite era, but they may have iOS devices that can't, whether for age reasons or for storage space reasons, possibly as well. What does that mean for them when they experience a sort of personal fragmentation across these different devices? What does that mean for them, and how does that impact them? And it impacts them mostly in frustration and confusion, as far as I can see so far. So it'll be interesting to see how much further does that go before people start to really run into the sand with some parts of my system, my personal suite, can't be upgraded to take advantage of these new features.
That's a great point, because personal fragmentation is, I don't think I've heard that before, but it's
made up.
Yeah, it's very true. It's very true.
Yeah, it is.
And you don't have, that problem doesn't exist when you're on the web, because it's the web.
And guess which device tends to be the oldest? It's actually the iPad. It's what I see more than anything else with people who aren't keeping up on the bleeding edge, which is most people. The one thing that they invest the least in is their tablet. Their Mac is, you know, important to them, and it works for them. Their phone is subsidized and contract, so it comes when it comes. But I've seen people hang on to iPad much, much longer than I've seen them hang on to any other device that they have in their life. So that's an interesting trend that will be interesting to see just how, to what extent can people keep up across three and soon to be four, if you count the watch as well, across four different hardware platforms with being on Apple's latest version of everything all the time. And that is an interesting question that I think has still to run its course in 2015.
One of the things I think we'll see this year too is 802.11ac will continue to grow. That'll be just the default at this point. You're seeing it across the Mac. You know, Macs have had it, gosh, I guess since 2013, they've had 802.11ac. The iPad Air 2 has it, and the iPhone 6 has it as well. So, you know, Wi-Fi planning and optimization is going to be a big thing, because you know, as we move more and more and we throw faster speeds at it, it's going to be better. It's going to be important that you're just designed properly and set up properly. Now, Wave 2 is probably going to come this year of 11AC. It's supposed to be even faster. I honestly don't expect you'll see client devices with it. Certainly in the iPad, iPhone style device for, gosh, maybe 2017. Certainly not this year, but maybe next year, but I kind of doubt it. Because I just don't think you need it. Because with most situations, 802.11ac outstrips the majority of people's bandwidth in terms of their WAN connection. And so your LAN in some ways only needs to be as fast as your WAN. You know, unless you're in a situation where you're, you know, having a, you know, you're transferring large videos across the LAN and things like that. But like in most schools, your WAN connection is your bottleneck. So, you know, what you do get is you get some ease on capacity with 11AC and things like that. But if just for the raw speed, most schools aren't going to take advantage of it. But it's certainly not. It is certainly nice to have. And it's not so much of a price premium when you're going to deploy Wi-Fi now that you should really even, you know, you should not be doing 11N, I would say, at this point. If you're doing new deployments, go ahead and pay a little bit extra money to get the 11AC if you can afford it. Again, 11N is still certainly fine, but you are putting in outdated technology, you know, as soon as you pull it out of the box.
Yeah, that's certainly something that's coming on strong. And I think, as you mentioned, Bradley, we've seen it more in desktops and laptops before we've seen it in mobile devices. And that tends to be the way of it with these kind of the radio chips, I guess, for power consumption reasons, that you can put them in the machines with the bigger batteries first, and then they have to get better before the second generation, before they come to the mobile devices. So, again, I think you've said this before, and I think this is one of your key insights into Wi-Fi, is that it's key to deploy according to what you expect to see come on your network, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if you're not expecting to see a lot of clients with AC, then I take your point about not buying old technology, but it may not be necessary to rush out and replace. And I think you've advocated that as well, not to necessarily run out and buy AC as soon as you can get it just to have it, until the device mix on your network justifies that as well.
Yeah, the only reason we're thinking about it is because our lease is up and I'm going to have to buy support. Yeah. And it's like, if I'm going to have to buy support on old APs, I'd almost just assume, you know, go ahead and just get into lease in. I mean, an AC's been out long enough where you don't feel like you're getting first-gen hardware. Like, you know, a lot of companies are on, you know, Gen 2 hardware, so it's getting a little bit more stable. And, yeah, we're slowly, as we add new devices, we are seeing more AC-capable clients. But again, they're, you know, mainly on the laptop side. But you're exactly right; it's all about battery power and really what the antennas can do as well. But you know, if you look at the iPhone, how fast the web page loads is in some ways the iPhone's processor and the way how fast Safari can render it versus the actual internet connection.
Yeah, and that's something that's a constraint or a bottleneck that's more unique to mobile devices, because certainly on the desktop, that's not usually your constraint, as the CPU performance of the machine is more your internet connection. But on the mobile device, it's a bit of both. Although with, you know, iPad Air 2 and things like that, they're starting to be as powerful as relatively recent laptops as well. So maybe the time has come for that.
So, you know, I think one of the other things that I've been interested to watch is like Google Classroom versus iTunes U. Because I think Apple iTunes U, it got a nice upgrade this year, but it does seem to move along at a glacial pace.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that Google Classroom came out with the feature set that it did, because it's very distinctly different to iTunes U. And I don't think it's correct to say at this point in time that the two are in direct competition with each other. I feel like they're as different as they are similar. But I've seen Google Classroom iterate at least once or twice already, and it'll be interesting to see if Google keeps up with the kind of web pace, if you like, of incremental changes as they become available, whereas iTunes U has really only had one major update, the 2.0 version, in its whole lifetime since 2012. So the original version and the major version after that. It'll be interesting to see, can iTunes U move a little bit faster, and does Google Classroom move more towards iTunes U in terms of its feature set? And for that matter, does iTunes U move towards Google Classroom? Because certainly there's an area of functionality that iTunes U could provide, that Google Classroom does provide, that iTunes U just doesn't touch at all, which is the handling of assignments and hand-in and so on. And that's an interesting question for 2015, is will Apple attack that area in any way at all? Watch this space.
We shall see. I would bet no. I mean, I think their focus is on the watch at this point. And, you know, obviously we're going to have, you know, wearables, I don't know, will be big in education for any time soon, except for needing to develop a policy about how to manage them in the classroom. I don't see the Apple Watch taking over the classroom in terms of, in a, you know, positive way. And so the question is, are their engineers are working on that versus things like iTunes U?
Yeah, I don't... I think it's interesting to think about that, because is it the case that an engineer is as good as any other engineer? And does Apple pull people off one project to put them on another project that's high priority? I know that has happened in Apple's history with things like the iPhone. You know, famously, they took a number of engineers off of, what was it, Leopard, in order to get iOS out the door, or iPhone out the door in the first place. So yes, that does happen from time to time. I know it also happened with Aperture back in the day when Aperture was trying to ship. They brought in people from other teams to try and get Aperture out the door. That was many years ago. But, you know, is it the case that the people who are writing iTunes U could be taken off iTunes U and made to go and work on the watch? I'm not sure that engineers are moved as far as that around Apple, but it would be interesting to see what happens. And does anything else make progress this first half of the year except the watch? That's a key question, I think. Time will only tell.
So anything else for, I guess, our year in review?
No, I think that's pretty much, I agree with you, Bradley. To me, it was quite a quiet year in terms of things we actually did versus things that we heard about, thought about, and might do things about in 2015. And I think one thing personally that I'm kind of interested in is trying to explore more options in terms of the services that I use. And I wrote a piece in my blog about this for the first time in ages, and which I talked about the whole going cloud first versus using locally installed and locally executing apps. And of course, it was with reference to Google Drive and Google Docs as the kind of foundational part. But there's many other services now, photo hosting services, music hosting services, and different things. But I'm really keen to kind of explore and try and see, you know, can I build a world in which I can live across iOS, Chrome OS, and the Mac seamlessly without being too dependent on, say, Apple's cloud technologies necessarily. So it's kind of like a sort of digital Rumspringa, if you like, to try and wander away a little bit and see what else is out there. And maybe, you know, I'll come back to the fold and just settle with the Apple stuff in time to come. But I think it's something that bears exploration right now, because I feel like one of the less well-observed themes of 2014 was that I feel this was a year that many other services got as good as Apple services, and in some cases got better than Apple services. So I'm talking about things like Google Play Music as an alternative to iTunes Match. I'm talking about things like Todoist as an alternative to OmniFocus, LastPass as an alternative to 1Password, Google Drive as an alternative to Dropbox, and so on and so on. So I'm going to explore that a little bit more, and we'll probably talk about it over a series of shows, just how these things could be made to be a little more device agnostic and a little bit more cloud centric, these key services that we use throughout the year.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a fun year. Of course, we'll be here probably most Monday, 95% of Monday mornings when you're making your drive off to work, you should have a new episode of Out of School in there. So we are thankful you have chosen to subscribe to us. If you like the show, we would appreciate if you leave a review in iTunes, or if you're in Overcast, you can recommend an episode. That helps us find new listeners, and that makes sponsors want to come back and sponsor more, and that helps us pay the bills and buy new equipment and invest in the show. So we would certainly appreciate that. Bradley Chambers on Twitter, and I'm on the web at chambersdaily.com.
And I'm Fraser Spears on Twitter and spears.org on the web. And just last reminder, I'm going to be speaking at the Bet Show in London on the 22nd and 23rd. It's Thursday and Friday of January, 22nd and 23rd. So if you are in the area, if you have a ticket for Bet, I'd love you to come along and hear what I've got to say.
Have a good week, everybody.